Hello, and welcome back to Bench to Bedside. I'm your host, Dr. Susan Firth, Executive Vice President and Chief Scientific Officer of the Research Institute. My guest today is Dr. Diana Montoya-Williams. She's an attending neonatologist whose research covers health disparities, social determinants of health, perinatal health policy, and immigration policies. Diana is also a faculty member at Policy Lab at CHOP. This year, she was named one of 23 women of STEM here at the Research Institute. And for the benefit of our listeners, STEM stands for the educational disciplines of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Welcome, Dr. Montoya-Williams.
Thank you so much for having me.
Diana, it's so great to have you here today. We're celebrating 100 years at the Research Institute. As we look back, in 1922, when the first research lab was set up here at CHOP, the acronym STEM wasn't even invented yet. It originated some 80 years later, in 2001, by administrators at the U.S. National Science Foundation. As a physician scientist who identifies as Colombian American, what advice do you have for others who are historically underrepresented in STEM fields as they make career choices?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for highlighting the history about the language of STEM. I didn't know about that myself. As I've been navigating these early stages of my own career, especially as someone who doesn't see a lot of people that are an immigrant or that look like me, one of the main things that has helped me the most is being able to find mentorship despite that lack of representation. What I've learned is that there are so many different types of mentorship and so many different types of people that can help you along your career. And that's been the case for me. I would have loved to have had another Latina growing up who I could look to in terms of science in my own neighborhood, in my medical school or a residency program, fellowship, or even now. But in the absence of that, what has been helpful is being able to find the allies and the people who are uplifting me or speaking my name or giving me opportunities, teaching me. Some of my mentors are the people that work in the community that I've worked at, people who have aligned interests and passions, but maybe are outside of academia. I feel like that's been a driving force and a motivation for me to do my work. And so I offer that as advice for someone who feels similarly underrepresented, is to find that community and to be really expansive in the search of where that community might come from in terms of people who might make you not just feel inspired, but give you the tools to succeed. What ends up happening often when you're underrepresented in a field is you feel that you are an only, or that there's no one that understands what you're dealing with or what your experiences have been when you struggle or even when you have successes. But if you can find those people to talk to listen to, and to surround yourself with, then it makes that journey so much easier.
What you said about finding allies is really important. I think when you're in a room and you don't see other people that look like you do, you can feel alone, but raising your hand and leaning in and continuing to do what you do, you inspire other people behind you. There's that old adage, you can't be what you can't see. When people like you step up and are so remarkably successful, I think it really inspires others. So I want to thank you for that.
Thank you.
Your research as a health equity scientist centers on drivers of racial and ethnic disparities in infant health outcomes, including preterm birth, low birth weight, and infant mortality. You also explore factors that are associated with some minority women being more resilient to poor birth outcomes, which is also fascinating. Would you tell us about your work and why the Research Institute at CHOP is an ideal place to explore this type of novel research?
Sure, absolutely. That was a great encapsulation. When I describe the work that I'm trying to do in my career, it is about two simultaneous paths or lines of inquiry. There's so much that we can do to continue to dig into the drivers of racial, ethnic, and nativity, or where someone is born, related disparities and inequities in birth outcomes. And as a neonatologist, that's why I chose to focus on birth outcomes like the ones you mentioned. There's still so much work to be done to dig into those drivers, and specifically social and structural drivers, as opposed to just individual characteristics associated with those inequities and those outcomes. things like neighborhood level disadvantage or social disinvestment in education, things like that. But at the same time, many of us who work in the health equity field realize and are called to by the communities we're trying to uplift to simultaneously work on solutions and be intervention oriented and to be rigorous about those solutions, those policies, those interventions to address and mitigate those inequities that we've been documenting for decades and which are pervasive and persistent, whether that is simple interventions that can happen within intensive care units or within pediatric offices, or larger scale, like policies that we need to advocate for at a state or federal level that could impact birth outcomes. And because it's two parallel lines of inquiry, this work can't be done in silo. It can't be done by one person or by one methodology even. It has to be work that is collaborative, that brings in voices that know about demography and sociology, but also understand how to do rigorous health services research and causal inference techniques, which are fancy ways to look at how policies impact population outcomes. And then you'll need the community perspective. You need so much expertise to do work that is aimed at documenting and mitigating inequities. And the Research Institute has so many people with different skills that can help contribute. And that's what I have found and why I feel at home here is because I have mentors and colleagues who have expertise in all of those areas that I just mentioned. A lot of what fuels my desire to continue contributing in this field is just being surrounded by other people who are just as passionate about doing something. It keeps me wanting to come to work and wanting to collaborate on projects because there's so many other people who are willing to do this with me.
That's terrific. I know that you are an active advocate for child health because we were in DC together talking to congressmen to try to raise the visibility of child health in our legislative branches. I also understand that you actively engage in immigrant child health advocacy, both locally and nationally. So can you tell us how and why this became a special area of interest for you?
Absolutely. I came to find this chosen area of science and research when I was in my fellowship for neonatology, and I discovered this rich literature base about racial and ethnic disparities in outcomes like preterm birth and infant mortality. My eyes were open to the staggering disparities among non-Hispanic Black communities in the United States. But while reading about that, I also learned about another phenomenon called the Hispanic paradox, which is this epidemiologic phenomenon that people have been documenting for about 50 years now. Hispanic communities and people here in the United States have health outcomes that appear to mirror non-Hispanic white communities more than the outcomes or the risk of poorer outcomes that non-Hispanic Black communities face, despite sharing very similar risk factors for poor health outcomes related to barriers to healthcare access, related to risk of medical comorbidities. And so that sparked my interest in understanding why is it that a group of people in this country who have significant barriers to good healthcare access, maybe even increased barriers to good healthcare access, if you think about immigration status and language proficiency, why do they sometimes at a population level have better health outcomes than expected? And so I started digging into that. And what it led me to is an understanding that the Hispanic paradox is situated within the immigrant paradox, and that immigrants are sometimes documented as having better birth outcomes, not just in the United States, but across the world, and that it's variable, and that not all groups that are immigrants and not all Hispanic people have those paradoxically good health outcomes. Through that journey of learning about these paradoxes or these epidemiologic phenomenon that made people feel like these are communities that have good health outcomes and are resilient to drivers of poor outcomes, and then recognizing that we have overlooked or not documented disparities that even exist within immigrant communities is what led me to where I am now, which is trying to better understand the health outcomes of immigrant pregnant people, but then also gave me the expertise after reading so many papers and contributing to the literature to recognize that there are policies that improve immigrants' lives and that improve immigrant health outcomes that we do not have systematically across this country. So my research has led to evidence-based advocacy in many ways. And it's absolutely informed by the fact that I am a first-generation immigrant Latina myself. These are personal issues to me, but it's very much informed by the amount of research and time I have spent trying to study this.
to drill down just a little bit more on some specific outcomes, can you talk about how your research has shed light on how immigration status and policy affects Hispanic women's perinatal and infant health outcomes?
This is a very timely question because historically, a lot of the literature has documented lower rates of preterm birth, lower rates of low birth weight, lower rates of mortality among first-generation Hispanic women, particularly from some countries versus others in the United States. So lower risks than you would expect given risk factors or similar risks than a non-Hispanic white pregnant person might have. In some places, in some contexts, maybe even slightly lower than non-Hispanic white pregnant people, which is considered the standard or the reference group. But what we have started to see is that when you drill down even more within groups that are all labeled as Hispanic, there's deep disparities there. And there is significant evidence now that the last 5 to 10 years of policies have started to erode some of this paradox within the Hispanic and immigrant community at large because of the rise of punitive immigration policies in the last 10 years. And so I'm particularly interested in how some policies that would be labeled as punitive because they criminalize someone based on their immigration status then impact healthcare access, healthcare behaviors, and therefore health outcomes. So for instance, when you enact a policy that maybe allows immigrants to be profiled and stopped and asked to show their documentation papers, we know that that then leads to what's called the chilling effect in terms of families not wanting to go to prenatal care appointments or not wanting to go to their primary care appointments, not necessarily wanting to take their kids to the doctor because they're worried about this profiling and what that might mean to their risk of citizenship or their risk of being deported and their families being separated. When you see policies that separate mothers and children at the border, you see that there is stress that is traumatic that is now getting passed on transgenerationally through women and through pregnant people, and that's going to impact birth outcomes. We know that stress impacts risk of preterm birth. So we have to study that to see the effect of those policies and in that way be able to inform legislators to say if the intent is to create safety or the intent is whatever you want to say the intent is, there are these unintended public health consequences to some of these policies, which is why this is such an important topic right now, because we've thought that maybe these communities have better health outcomes, but there is such risk and evidence of such an erosion in those birth outcomes that are positive that we need to document that now.
In identifying these risk factors and your health equity research, how do you set the stage to develop and implement interventions and policies that could influence these adverse outcomes on children's health?
It's a great question. And the short answer is through that collaborative work we talked about earlier. I'll give you an example of one of the projects and one of the studies that I'm working on right now, which is labeled Promoting Resilience in Immigrant Mamas, PRIMA. What we're trying to do in that study is gather immigrant pregnant people's birthing experiences here in Philadelphia to have them tell us their stories of what it was like to be pregnant in the last 2 years, to go through the prenatal care experience or not. And then to tell us from their perspective if there was any concerns related to their immigration status, if they heard about those concerns in the community, and then what we should do about that from a healthcare systems perspective. So what would they have wanted to see, or what would they have wanted to feel, or what should they not have seen or felt? What should we not have done from both a system perspective or even an interpersonal perspective in the clinical setting in order to try to get a community-informed perspective on how to mitigate the chilling effect that we know is happening, that this fear and stress around seeking healthcare and social services that people are entitled to that they might be worried about using or stressed about using or even just confused about whether or not they still qualify for it in light of all of the debates regarding the public charge legislation in recent years. And so getting that community-informed data about what we can do as a healthcare system was a collaborative effort so that we can say here in Philadelphia, we decided to do this in these two hospitals. This is what the impact was. This was suggested by community members. Perhaps you can try it in your university setting or your community setting. And so to me, the answer for how you start to develop interventions to address health equity is by making the concerted effort to involve members from the community as paid, compensated research team members, but then also being rigorous to study those interventions as we would the newest cancer drug or the newest other therapeutic that we have to have that same investment. We have to have the same level of funding. We should be doing rigorous natural experiments or rigorous equity-focused quality improvement, writing about it, improving about it, and then getting it back to the community and making sure people are trying it in other contexts.
That's wonderful and brings it full circle from community engagement to impact. So lastly, something I ask all my guests. So what is it about the CHOP Research Institute that's inspired you to build your research career here?
The best way to describe it is that I want to dedicate my life to the creation of advocacy-informed research and then evidence-based advocacy. They almost feel like two different hats, right? On the one hand, it's the hat of the physician scientist, but I always want my science and my research to be informed by the issues that matter to the communities I'm trying to help. So advocacy-informed research. But I'm also passionate about making sure that what we learn in science and all the knowledge and the information we generate within academic institutions doesn't only live there, and that it translates into something that changes in broader society. So I'm interested in making sure that when I read papers and realize that, for instance, paid family leave makes sense and saves lives, that that translates into a policy. So evidence-based policy advocacy is the other hat that I like to wear, the other pillar of my life. Honestly, being at the Research Institute, having a home within the Department of Neonatology's Health Services Research, but then also Policy Lab, is the way that I get to do both of those things and merge them into a career that makes sense, that doesn't feel like they're fighting goals, that doesn't feel like one of those passions is taking time away from the other, but that they inform each other, the research that I do and the advocacy that I do. I have the resources, the motivation, and the community to be able to do both of those paths at the same time.
That's great. So thank you so much, Dr. Montoya Williams. Please join me next time as we explore our first centers of emphasis and how they've grown. For more stories about the people of the Research Institute and the incredible work that they're doing, visit our blog, Cornerstone, at research.chop.edu/cornerstone-blog. Thanks very much.